Hi everyone, my name's Susan and I'm an addict. And I'm really, really nervous sitting here. And I've learned a lot of things since I've been in recovery. And one of the things that I have learned is that my troubles are of my own making. And I really understand that sitting in this chair even more because I've created this thing in my head. You know, I'm causing trouble for myself and it's causing me a lot of anxiety. My hands are sweating, my mouth's going all dry, and it's like I'm coming up on an E, you know. It's like I'm going to be rushing any minute now. And another thing that I've learned here is that my feelings, you know, I'm in touch with my emotional nature. And I feel really, really nervous. But I've learned here that it doesn't really matter how I feel, I don't have to use, you know, because... with this feeling, I would have just left here and gone and got a drink before in the past. But I know that this feeling will pass. As I continue to talk and share my experience with you guys, I know that it will feel better. I will feel better without a drink or a drug. And I will feel better than having a drink or a drug. That's my experience of sharing with other people. I never knew that before, and I'm starting to feel a bit better now. And the first thing that I'd like to say is... God, direct my attention to what you'd have me be right now. I feel quite emotional, you know, because I couldn't really do this stuff without alcohol and drugs, and I couldn't do it since coming into recovery without having a power in my life, you know. I had to tap into a power, I had to tap into a source to live, because I couldn't live without a power. And that's what I learned when I come into recovery. When I came into recovery, I learned that lack of power was my dilemma. I learned that I didn't know how to live. My life was unmanageable, you know. I couldn't have relationships with anyone, you know. I couldn't get in touch with my emotional nature. I used to run away from the way I felt. And I always felt useless. And all that's changed today, you know. As a result of working the 12 steps on a daily basis, I've had a spiritual awakening. You know, I've had a spiritual experience, well, many spiritual experiences. But I've changed, you know, and I am going to tell you a bit about my using, but I don't really want to do that right now. I just want to share about where I am in recovery today, and recovery is really beautiful for me, you know. I don't know, even my difficulties and in my struggles, I still see joy, you know. It's still a beautiful place for me to be, because it's so much better, you know, from where I am today to where I was. You know, I'm doing loads of things in my life, loads of beautiful things in my life, and the things that I'm doing today in my life is all what I want to do. You know, I'm doing a college course today, and it's a college course that I'm paying for, and it's what I want to do. I love the information that I learn on that course. I'm going through the process again. I've been through the process many times, and that's okay. You know, I'm going through the process again, and I'm learning more, and I love it. You know, I've started taking driving lessons. I know that I suffer from an addiction, an illness that tells me that I'm no good, and nothing's good for me, and I should just walk everywhere, and you're not going to drive, Susan, because if you drive, you're going to have a car accident. Your car? No, the illness has said to me, don't drive, because if you drive, your car's going to go up in the air and turn over, and you're going to die, you know, so don't get a car. You know, just... my illness wants me separated, you know, and today I'm taking driving lessons, you know, I'm having relationships with people, I work today, you know, I work with other people, I share this stuff, recovery, my experience with other females, you know, I'm having a relationship with my child. I couldn't have a relationship with my child before, you know. I disowned my daughter. I neglected her for many years. I'm having a relationship with my mother. I hated my father. Before I learned that my troubles were of my own making, it was all my dad's fault why I was living the way I was living, you know. And I go to college today, once a week. It's a 2-year course, and I'm going to qualify, you know. I believe I'm that person already. But I've got to go to college just for society's sake and government's sake, you know, to get the qualification. But I know within me I am that person, you know. And I go to college and my dad doesn't live too far from the college. And what happens is at lunchtime I go to his house and he cooks for me. You know, my dad makes me lunch, really nice food, you know, like steamed fish. yam, dumpling, banana. I've never ever eaten a meal from my dad. I'm 39 years old and I've never ever had a meal from my father before. And I've been on this course 4 weeks, and for 4 weeks I've been to my dad's house and I've had a meal. When I first got into recovery, my dad came round to my house and he baked a cake, a Christmas cake. And he bought me a bit, you know, he cut a bit for me, wrapped up in foil, and he was handing it to me. And all I could smell was the alcohol. And I was like, damn, the first time you've ever baked a cake and given me a bit, it's got alcohol in it and I can't eat it. That's my choice. I don't know if people live their recovery like that, but I don't have anything to do with alcohol, nothing to do with it. So I couldn't eat the cake. But I'm eating food from my father now, and at first it was really uncomfortable, you know, and now it feels really, it feels good. It feels like, yeah, this is it, this is real, this is what's happening, you know. He's your father, he sits there with his newspaper, his glasses on, and I'm like, Dad, you all right? You happy? And he's like, yeah, and he's got diabetes, and I'm like, so how's your diabetes? You know, and it's all fear. I feel really shaky, but it's all fear. Fear of not having quality time with my dad because he could pass away. You know, he's an old man, he's in his 60s and he's got diabetes. My gran, when I first got into recovery, she died of diabetes, you know, and I never used. I was in treatment and I went to her funeral and I never picked up. My cousins were offering me alcohol, cannabis, taking the piss, I believe, you know, but I never used it. I just didn't want it because when I came here, I admitted complete defeat. And if no one knows what complete defeat is, I was battered. Not physically, like, you know, black eyes and stuff, but inside, I just couldn't go on anymore. But I'll get to all of that. But my dad, you know, we're having a relationship today, and it's really beautiful. I never, ever thought that that could happen. You know, I really didn't think that I would have a relationship with my father, because it was all his fault. And today I know the truth. And that's what I've learned in recovery. In recovery, I've learned the truth. In my addiction, in the insanity, I was living in lies, you know. I believe in two forces. I'm really going to be honest today, because before I'd share and I'd be careful of what I said because of what people would think about me, you know. But today I don't give a shit, you know. I don't care what you think about me, because I know everybody in this room is not perfect, even if you think you are, you're not. So let me be the bearer of that news, you know. But your illness will try and tell you, your addiction, the other part of you, will try and say to you, look, you can't do it because you're not perfect. You never will be perfect. You know, there's only one ultimate authority, and that one is God, and he's perfect, or she, whatever your belief is, whatever your higher power is. I call my higher power God, you know, and my God's perfect, you know, and I just strive for perfection. But I know I'll never ever get it. It's about spiritual progress as well, you know. It's not about spiritual perfection, even though I'm striving for it. I really want to be good, you know. I want my life to be perfect. I give myself a hard time sometimes, even though I know it's not going to be like that. So I believe in two forces, and I believe in the devil. And I don't believe in the devil, but I believe that the devil exists. And I believe in God, you know. And in my addiction, let's get there. In my addiction, I was working with the devil. You know, I was working with this dark force that had me doing things. Can you imagine? Doing things that I didn't want to do. You know, walking on the street as a prostitute, I didn't want to be there. But I was driven, you know, driven by fear and self-delusion. Frightened about what you guys would think about me, you know, and really frightened to express who I was, really frightened to say I feel really scared to do this, or I feel really happy, or I feel really angry about what you said, you know, just really frightened to expose myself, just wearing a mask, you know, being the actor. And so I'd done things that I really didn't want to do, you know. I'd leave my daughter at school gates, you know, because I couldn't pick her up because I was busy smoking crack cocaine, you know, and I didn't want to do that. And all I wanted was just to have, like, just one little user, one little drink. And then as soon as I started, I couldn't stop. And I didn't understand why. And then weeks would go by and I'd forget about it, you know, that happened that time, and I would try it again. And what I've learnt, similar to what Paul was saying, is that I believe that when I use a drink or a drug, it sets off an abnormal reaction. If there's any newcomers here, it's about listening, because that's what I had to do. When I went to my meetings in my early days, I had to listen, Because I never listened to anyone. Because what? Susan knew it all. I didn't know anything. When I come into recovery, that's when I learned. You know, and I heard and I learned that I have an abnormal reaction. And I believe it. I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol and drugs. When I use that stuff, I behave differently. You know, I've drank with many people and they don't behave like me. You know, I've used drugs with many people and they don't behave like me. You know, I have a sister and I can remember one time taking her to a crack house. You know, my decent sister. All I was thinking about was myself. You know, just come with me, man. I want to take you somewhere. And I brought her to the house. She was like, what is this, Susan? And I said to her, go on, just buy something. Oh, my God. And it was 50 quid, you know. She bought a £50 thing and we smoked it. And the next day she phoned me up. She was fuming. She was like, I took my £50 and bought that rubbish. You know, and I was like, what are you going on about, man? You know, like, can you call it rubbish? And she's never done it again. My sister's never done that again. And I've done it time and time and time. You know, tired, sick and tired, and just continue doing it. And I learned that it's because I have an abnormal reaction. And even when I don't want to do it, a thought comes into my head. And the thought says to me, why don't you just get one? You know, and then I'd hear a voice inside. And that's my consciousness. That's what I believe I'm working with today. The good part of me, the good source. And I'd hear this voice that says, Susan, you better don't do that, you know. And then this voice in my head would be like, look, just get one. And then this voice would be like, you know you shouldn't do that because you know what's going to happen. And then the voice in my head will get louder. Just get one. And then the voice, my consciousness will be quieting down. Like, you know, I'll be like, I can't hear it. All I can hear is, just get it. And I'll be out. And that's the obsession, you know, the obsession driven by it. And I'll be through that door scoring. You know, just like running, and then I'd be back at home, got no more money left, and I'd be like, I had a black table so I could see the white spots, you know, and I'd be like that. On the table, you know, searching, feeling for all the white spots, picking up all white specks off the floor, rice grains. You know, has that ever happened to anyone here? Like, there'll be no spots on the floor, but as soon as you take that lick, the whole floor is covered in white spots. How does that happen? You know, that always used to happen to me. I couldn't handle it, but I couldn't stop it. You know, so anyway, my illness, it really got progressive, you know, through the fear from as a little child, you know, my dad beating up my mother, me not really liking my mum because thinking, why are you in this relationship? Really, really angry, really pissed off as a child with these two people who were supposed to be looking after me. And we lived in a house as well. We lived in a house in Tottenham near an area called Broadwater Farm. And I ventured over there. I heard about this place and I heard, don't you dare go over there, Susan. People get killed over there. Do you know what I mean? This is what I heard, but it's not true. Right? I heard this stuff. And me and my mum, as a little kid, you know, and my dad, we lived in this house. They were renting a room upstairs. And my dad used to really beat up my mum. I don't really know what was going on, but I just knew that I was nervous, really scared. I used to piss myself. When he used to push the door to come in, I used to wet myself, you know, like, oh my God, they're going to fight again, you know. And when my dad used to hit my mum, I used to run downstairs as a little kid and ask the people who they were renting upstairs from, can you please go upstairs and save my mother? And since being in recovery, and they did, they would, and they'd say, John, that's my dad's name, stop fighting Ina, you know. And since being in recovery, these two people have died, you know, my two little protectors, you know. One died last year and one died this year. And I've been to their funeral, both of their funerals, and they look like they're just resting, sleeping, you know, at peace, really, really beautiful, resting. They've served their purpose here. And there were people there that were taking the piss, drinking, smoking, drugs, you know, the people from Broadwater Farm. Smoking, you know, all that stuff was going on. And I was looking at them like, you lot ain't got nothing that I want. Now, that's a revelation for me, because I used to look at them people and think, I want exactly what you've got. All I ever wanted was to be out of it. You know, I just wanted to be out of it. I used to see tramps on the bench, you know, and I used to say, yeah, I want to be like them, man. They look like they're happy. I couldn't cope. As a young child, I just couldn't cope. Me and my mum, we left that house, left my dad, moved into our own property. My dad used to come around there knocking on the door, though, and I'd say, Mum, you've got to open the door because he's going to kick it off and stuff, because that's what my dad used to do, kick off doors and stuff, you know. And my mum wouldn't open it, and I thought, yeah, she's getting some strength back. But I was restless, You know, I had this void. I didn't really have I had love, but I didn't feel at the time that I was given enough love and attention and protection. I didn't feel that I was being looked after, full of fear, driven by fear. You know, I used to go to school and I used to act up because I wanted some attention from people. I wanted people to look after me. So I used to do what they wanted me to, even though I didn't want to, just to get friends, just to get some kind of recognition. And I used to drink alcohol as well. At a young age, I started drinking alcohol. I used to drink my mum's beers as Skulls from the fridge, you know, because she used to mix Skull and orange or Skull and syrup, you know, and I used to, like, nick the Skull and drink it. I used to sit on benches at a young age drinking Tennent's. I used to pick up cigarette butts off the floor at a young age, smoking in dustbin sheds, you know, really irritable. Hated myself. And then I can remember going into secondary school, someone coming over there in the school, stole cannabis from their father, you know, and they said, so who's going to smoke it? Who do you think said, yeah, me? Me. I'll smoke it first, you know, and I smoked it. I got kicked out of school, you know, and it just progressed. This illness just progressed. All I was looking for was something to fix me, something to change the way I felt. And these things worked. All I wanted was something to take away the fear, and these things worked. You know, they took away the fear from me. Drinking more, smoking cannabis, taking ecstasy tablets. Sound like a jockey now, isn't it? Smoking, you know, taking ecstasy. Taking ecstasy, snorting cocaine, crack cocaine, and heroin. That is it, you know. On and on. 20 years old, I get pregnant. I'm in a relationship, and I decide, right, I want to have a baby. I don't ask or talk to my partner about it. You know, like what I think normal people do, like, what do you think? Should we have a baby? I just decide, I'm coming off of contraceptions and I'm going to have a baby because maybe a child is going to fix it. And then I have my baby, 1989. That's when I got introduced to crack cocaine, actually, in 1989. You know, after having my daughter in October, by December, I was licking pipe, man. You know, it didn't sort it out. My daughter never fixed it. You know, and then it progressed. I took a lick, 1989, and I used from 1989 to 2002, progressively, looking for that hit that I got in 1989. Searching for that pipe, and I could never find it. And I'd done anything, I went to any lengths to get it, and I never got it. So I gave up in the end because I had to. The police came to my house, turned my house into a crack house. All this sort of behaviour, you know. I turned my flat into a crack house twice. I thought if the dealer comes to my house, this is what my head told me, get the dealer in. Because if the dealer comes in, all the drugs will be yours. Do you know what I mean? It never said to me, actually, the dealer's going to be doing business and it's very dangerous because the police are going to come round. Never said that. You know, all the drugs are going to be yours. And what happened was the dealer did come round and they used to cut up on a plate, you know, and wrap up and all that, and then there would be crumbs on the plate, and they would just say to me, and that's the excess, and I used to like that word, you know, that's the excess, and that's yours. And I'd be like, yeah, wicked. And I'd smoke that, didn't know about the abnormal reaction will kick in, and then I'd be knocking on my own bedroom door, because they've taken over, haven't they? And I'd be knocking on my own bedroom door, like, I need more. Can you give me some more? And they'd be like, no, you're too greedy. So I had to leave back on the streets and I went to another crack house. And I thought, I'm spiting them in my house, so I'll go somewhere else and spend my money, you know? I'm free from that madness today. You know, I don't want to go back to using. I really don't want to use. I don't want to use drugs. I don't want to drink alcohol to change the way I feel anymore. Because as I said, when I do it, I behave differently to normal people. I just can't do it. Can you imagine me turning my ass into a crack house today? I just can't see it. I'd lose my job. I'd be telling the dealers, come to my workplace and meet me. Do you know what I mean? I'd be smoking at work. It just can't happen, you know, for me. So what I had to do, the police come to my house with guns, you know, infrared on me, get down, come on. And I was like, oh my days, you know, with my hands up in the air. Never seen anything like it, apart from on the movie, you know, on the TV. And I got sentenced in 2000. I got a 7-year prison sentence. It was 11 years, actually. 7 years for conspiracy to supply. And 4 years for handling stolen goods. because there was loads of stolen property in my house, you know. But the judge said to run concurrent, thank God. And it was in that prison, after serving 2 years, after serving 3 years and 4 months, it was in that prison, I realised that I had a problem. And that's what I've read. I've read somewhere, it could be in the AA book or this book, that I should have stopped using a long time ago before I asked for help. You know, when I asked for help, that weren't really the time to ask for help. I should have asked for help a long time ago, but I didn't. I thought I had it under control. That's what the addiction does to me. You know, the illness deludes me and tells me, you've got it all under control, Susan. Things are moving out of my house. The telly's going. But my head's saying, but it's all right, you've got it under control. Do you know what I mean? My cable's been cut off. And I'm like, they've cut off my cable, you know, to the people that I'm smoking with. And they're like, bastards. Wankers. And then I go to my mum's house and I'm like, Mum, they cut off my cable, you know. And she's like, well, did you pay the bill? And then I'm hating her for it, you know. I couldn't live. My electricity, wired. Do you know what I mean? My electricity was wired. I was so unmanageable and disconnected to the world, to society. So yeah, in prison, I had a dream that I was with some guy that I was seeing in my addiction. I hadn't seen him for years, but I've had this dream in the cell. And where are we? Broadwater Farm. So we're walking hands in hands over Broadwater Farm. And I'm walking in something, and it's getting higher and higher and higher. And I'm like, where are we going? And he said, we're going to go and buy a rock. You know, and I'm like, well, I don't really want to buy a rock. But I'm still holding his hand. And then I'm like, and what's this that I'm walking in? And he said, beer. Beer that you love. And I thought, I don't love beer. And I let go of his hand, and I started running. And I woke up, and I was still in prison. 2003 this was. Got sentenced 2000. 2003. I was still in prison, and it was only then, you know, I said, thank God for the judge for sentencing me, because I never want to go back there again. It was only then I realised that it was my fault why I was in prison, because all the other time, I was in there saying, I don't know why I'm here, the judge sent me here. I don't know why I'm here. The judge is a bastard. You know, but it was only after that dream I really saw the beauty of it. You know, I really saw that, I'm here for a reason, man. I'm here because if I go back out there, I'm going to be going back to smoking crack, and alcohol is going to be the death of me, because it was drowning me, you know. And when they opened the prison door, when they opened my cell door, I spoke to a few girls on the landing, and I said, you know what? I'm asking for help, mate. I can't live this life anymore. I'm going to a carrot worker, a drug worker, and I'm going to see what she can do with me. And I heard them, they're sick, bless them. They said, oh, Susan, you're institutionalised. Don't go. Don't answer, you'll be all right, man. And these are people who I've seen come in and out on my sentence, in and out, I'm like, in the dinner queue. So what's happened to you then? How come you're back here? They're like, oh, I got back with him, didn't I? And I'm like, who? And they're blaming their partner. And I'm like, well, did you use? And they're like, well, yeah, because he had it, and like, he gave me some. And then they ended up committing crime. And these are the people that are telling me that I'm institutionalised. And I thought, you know what? That's the other voice. Don't listen to them. And it was really strong. It was powerful. Go and ask for help. And I went and I asked for help. And that's when my journey took off. I got guided, you know, to a treatment centre in Bournemouth. 12-step treatment centre. You know, I was told, and I listened, you know, because I was beaten. The only thing I had was a little bit of hope and a pulley with some prison clothes in there that I was wearing every 2 months, because I'd get a change of clothes every 2 months in jail. So that's what I had, the pulley and a little bit of hope. Not even a front door key. My house was gone because, you know, they took it back, you know, and they said that I made myself intentionally homeless by turning it into a crack house. So I've gone to this treatment centre, and they've said to me, I've got to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And this was in 2003, okay? And when I went to, treatment, I was 18 months clean. And today I'm in my seventh year of sobriety. I'm in my seventh year of recovery. And I don't smoke cigarettes anymore either. I stopped smoking cigarettes in 2005. So I'm in my 7th year of sobriety and I still come to meetings. But in 2003 I heard, do 90 meetings in 90 days. What I understand now is I have to come to meetings frequently to meet newcomers, to carry this message, man, to help people, you know. 90 meetings in 90 days is not sufficient for me, you know. I have to go to the same lengths that I went to get messed up. I really want to swear, you know, but I'm not going to. I'm really going to, like, maintain it and learn, like, use other words, Susan. I went to any lengths to get, you know, messed up. And now I go to any lengths to get well, man, you know, because the drink and the drug that I took today wasn't last tomorrow. You know, I'd have to do it again. So what I do today is enough for 24 hours today, and then tomorrow I have to put more work in. You know, it's continuous for me. And some guy at the back there, he was saying that he met me at Islington. He was saying, so do you still do your step 10s every night? Or do you still take inventory every night? And I said, no. And he said, don't ya? And he looked at me like, you're going off your head then, you know? And I said, I take regular inventory, but I don't do it every night. And that's okay. I used to take inventory religiously. Someone told me to do that, you know. Make sure you take inventory. And I used to get really frightened, like, well, what's going to happen? You know what I mean? Like, what's going to happen to me if I don't, like, take it one night? I used to get really frightened. But I've tried it, and everything's all right, you know. But I do it. I might do it 4 times in a week rather than 7. You know, and that's okay for me, because I don't harm people during the day and then say, it's all right, tonight I'll just take inventory and then tomorrow if I see them, I'll make amends. You know, it's just continuous for me. I watch my behaviour right throughout the day, you know. I'm on top of it. I'm on top of my behaviour throughout the day. And I know when I've done something wrong. I've been awakened. My spirit's been awakened, you know. I'm no longer in denial. And I ask for help. I continue to ask for help. Anyway, in this treatment centre, I got to that step 4. I learnt about powerlessness. I learnt that lack of power was my dilemma. I learnt that I needed to have a power in my life. If I've got no power, then I need power, because I'm powerless. So I need some power, you know. And I can remember being in that treatment centre, actually, and saying that the power that I was going to have was going to be God, just at step 2, you know. And step 2, it's about a willingness, you know, just willing to believe that there's power out there greater than us. And there is, because I know that I'm not great. I'm not all that, really. I'm just really insignificant, you know. I'm really not all that. But there is something that's greater than me. And I thought that I'm going to have God. When I was in the treatment centre, I said, right, I'm going to go for God. And the reason why I said God was because I can remember living at home with my mum as a little girl. And, you know, my mum, she worked really hard to look after me. I was really ungrateful. You know, the spiritual malady that Paul spoke about, restless, irritable and discontented, nothing was enough for me. And my mum was doing her best, you know. And I'd look in the cupboards and there'd be like a pack of rice, tin of corned beef. And I'd be like, right, so what were we eating for dinner then? And she'd be like, that, we're having rice and corned beef. And I'd say, so what are we going to have tomorrow? You know, and she'd be like, you stay there, Susan. God will provide. And I used to hate it. She never just said it once, she said it continuously. And I used to think, what is this? Who's God? You know, is someone really, God's going to come knocking at the door with some shopping, you know? And what used to happen, well, someone would come round and say, Ina, I was just passing and I'm just dropping you off for £20. Back in them days, £20 was a lot. You know, I'm just dropping you off for £20. And she would say, now put on your clothes, we're going to Fine Fair. I don't know if anybody knows about Fine Fair. You know, we're going Fine Fair. It's not like Tesco's. It's better. It's better. And we'll go to Fine Fair and we'll do our shopping, you know? And that's what I remembered in that treatment centre. In that treatment centre, I remembered that my mum spoke about God, and God was a providing God, and that's who I'm going to go with. And that's who my power was going to be, you know, and I still have that God today. It's grown, the relationship with God has grown, and my belief in God has really, really grown, you know, but my God's still providing, provides a lot for me, man. So my step three was making a decision, and it's still the same today. You know, just making a decision not to go back to being powerless, but making a decision to live in the solution on a daily basis. You know, and how I went about doing that first, my very first step four, I was frightened. I was petrified. I used to hear in the meetings in Bournemouth, "Don't you dare do that step four." And this is people carrying messages to me, and you remember I'm listening. You know, so I thought, shit, what's that? What happens when you do that step four? I can't do it. And then I heard a guy share in a meeting who was doing a step three share. And he said, and if you've just done step three, you know, the next thing you need to do is step four. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. So I went home and I took inventory. And because I still had that kind of like authority head on me, I thought, right, I'm not going to, you know, share it with the people in the treatment centre. I'm going to go to a priest. And the reason why I went to a priest was because I thought that he was the nearest person to God. You know, because he had the white collar on and all that. But I believe I'm nearer to God than any priest now. You know, I'm sure lots of us in this room are nearer to God than a priest. You know, but that's what my thinking was then. So I shared it with the priest. And the priest, we'd done Our Father prayer. And he says, yeah, God has forgiven you. But what happened then was, and in the book that I read, the AA book as well, it talks about feeling the nearness of our Creator, you know, and I did. I felt, I don't know if I felt the nearness of our Creator, but my understanding of that is I felt connected to the world. I didn't feel separate anymore. I didn't feel different anymore. When I left that church, I felt like, yeah, I belong. I felt like I belonged there. I really can't explain the feeling, but I didn't feel different. I didn't feel special and unique anymore. I just felt at one, yeah, with God and the universe. I felt together. And I started going to meetings and I started sharing my truth. You know, I started opening up. I got a sponsor. I've been through the process, as I said, many times. I'm going through the process now. And it's a continuous thing for me. You know, I continue to take inventory. Not every night, but I continue to take inventory. And I continue to ask God, you know, it's like a flip side, the other side of the coin, you know. I continue to ask Him, God, to remove my defects of character. You know, like, if I feel that I'm going to be selfish, or if I have been selfish, I say, God, you know, what should I do? You know, or I share it with someone, you know, like in this situation, I think that I harmed them, or, and they say, well, what do you think you should do, Susan? I'm like, well, I really don't know. And then, you know, we talk about it and something happens. Or if I'm going to be dishonest, you know, I remember sharing at this meeting before for 15 minutes and sharing that at that stage in 2005 or 6, I think it was. It might have been 2006. I weren't paying my fares on the trains, you know, but I pay my fares now. You know, I've got my Oyster card in my pocket and I buy my monthly travel card to Luton, you know, because I had a fear of financial insecurity, so I used to get a lift from someone who works at the treatment centre. I work in a treatment centre. I used to get a lift from someone there. And I just realised that it was greed. You're being greedy, Susan. You just don't want to buy a travel card. And then one day, you know, it just came to me. Just inquire how much the travel card costs, because my head told me it was my whole wages. Do you know what I mean? Inquire and find out how much does a travel card cost. And when I heard the price, I was like, is that all? Do you know what I mean? Is that it? So I bought it, and I haven't stopped buying my travel card. And I buy my travel card, and I travel to work. And they come on the train, and sometimes I can act like, where's my ticket? You know, like, just for a bit of excitement, but I know I've got it. For a bit of excitement. And then I show it to them, because I know I'm legal, you know? And I just show it to them. It's mental, isn't it? And I do all this on my own, you know? No one's influencing me, no dad, you know, no dad with me, I do it all by myself. But anyway, so what happens is, I ask God, Him, to remove my shortcomings, as I said to you before, you know, and where I'm being dishonest, I'll be honest. Where I'm being selfish, I'll be selfless. If I'm full of fear, I'll say a little prayer and I ask God to give me faith. If I'm trying to control a situation or an outcome before I've even taken action, because I sometimes can say I know what's going to happen and I haven't even done it. I just know what's going to happen, but it's fear. Fear stops me. Fear steals away my opportunities. I remember going to Spain and, you know, going to the Rock of Gibraltar. You know, going to Gibraltar and a man coming out of his van and saying, would you like to come up on the Rock? And straight away my head said, no. Don't you dare go up there. And I had a conversation before answering the man, like, why not? And my head said, because the Rock's going to fall down. It's going to collapse, Susan, if you go up there. And then I had to say, is this the truth? And then I heard, no, you're going to miss out if you don't go up there. And then I heard my partner saying, there's monkeys up there. And I thought, yeah, I'm going up there, man. But fear, the illness, wants to steal away all my opportunities, you know, all the opportunities in life. This illness wants to take away from me. This illness wants me to be separated, wants me to be lonely. I don't even have to be using. It just doesn't want me to enjoy life. It doesn't want me to enjoy God's creation, the beauty of it. It doesn't want me to enjoy it. It wants me separated by myself at home, saying, what the hell is this all about? I just want to die. I want to commit suicide. That's what it wants. So anyway, my journey's beautiful. I've had many, many experiences. You know, as I said, I've had sad times. I've been to funerals in recovery. Something like, not serious, but I don't know, something difficult happens with my daughter. And I was there, I was present to support her. Are you saying 5 minutes?
I am.
Okay. Something difficult happens with my daughter. And I had to be there to support her. And I did. And I felt like I'd done that like an adult. This is what recovery's done for me. You know, it's enabled me to grow up. It's enabled me to take responsibility. You know, and I neglected this little girl for many years, and she got herself into a situation where she needed help, and I was available, and I feel quite emotional. You know, I was available to help my daughter. You know, I weren't smoking crack and hearing about it from somebody else. She shared it with me, you know, and I supported her with it. And my mother, you know, she got dragged up in this addiction. Her hair fell out. My poor mom, her hair fell out. She lost her hair because of me. And when I went to prison, the only people that came to see me was my mother and my daughter, man. And then people that were in my house, they never come to see me. They ain't got a resentment, even though it sounds like I have got one. But they never came, you know. It was just my mum and my daughter. What can I say in 5 minutes if you're a newcomer? I think if you are a newcomer and you're trying to control your using right now and you're finding it very, very difficult, just like I used to think that I could control it and this time it was going to be different. That's what my head used to tell me all the time, and I'll do it, and then my head will say, you stupid cow, you've done it now, ain't ya? You know, switch on me. So what I suggest you do is ask for help. This is what was suggested to me, yeah? Continue to ask for help, get a sponsor, get taken through the 12 steps, help somebody else. Pass this message on to somebody else and your life changes. You know, and my life has definitely changed. You know, as I said, I am a different person. My beliefs are different. My beliefs are my own. I used to hear people say you can't wear trainers with white socks. So I would never ever do that. Today I do. You know, that's just a simple one, you know, but I used to just believe all sorts of stuff. I used to hear people from over Broadwater Farm, you know, say the police. They're only picking on us because we're black. So I started that. I'd be shoplifting, get arrested, and I'd be like, you're only picking on me because I'm black. Ain't you? Why don't you leave me alone? And today, guess what? The police don't arrest me today, and I'm still bloody black. So how do you work it out? How do you work it out? Hey? It's a miracle. I'll pay my bills today as well. My electricity is not wired, you know. I pay my bills. I've got many things in my life as well, you know, not just externally, but internally, you know. I've got confidence, even though I might feel nervous and that, but I've got confidence. I can have a conversation with people without being drunk, you know, because I used to think I spoke really well when I was drunk, you know. I was making a lot of sense, even though they said, shut up, Susan. People used to warn me, they used to say, please, Susan, you're coming out with me now, please don't drink. And so what are you talking about? You know, but I mean, I don't know, maybe step 11 and 12. So step 10 is just a continuation of this stuff, you know, working with people, looking at when you've been dishonest, resentments, fear, and sharing it with someone else. I don't know when the obsession to use lifted, but it's gone. I don't wake up in the morning with a burning desire or obsessed about where am I going to get it from and how much money have I got and where am I going to meet them. I don't wake up with that stuff. I wake up with Let me pray. Let me read my daily books, my daily readings, morning meditation, sit still, ask God, what do you want me to do for you today, God? Not do for me today. Who can I help today, God? Have my bath. I have a bath. I wash today. I don't just put on my clothes, dirty clothes. I used to put on dirty clothes. I wash, I put on ironed clothes. How amazing is that? And I make my way to work really happy. Really happy. Not depressed. Like, I don't want to go to that bloody job. Or think about, what lie can I tell them to not come in? I just go to work and I love my job, you know. And step 11 for me is about continuing to seek conscious contact with God, with this higher power, because I need it. I need power in my life because lack of power is Susan's dilemma. So I need power to live, you know. So I'm continuously searching for this power. I don't know what God looks like. Can't touch God, but I have a belief that my God is providing, caring, always there, never lets me down, forever faithful. Man, forever, ever faithful, my God. You know, and my God loves me just the way I am, even if human beings struggle with me. I don't give a toss. I know that God, the power, who's going to look after me and give me all what I need, what I thought human beings could give me. I used to have a man, and I used to drain the man dry because I used to think, you're not giving it to me, man. You know, but human beings just haven't got it all, you know, but God's got it all. You know, human beings can only give me so much. And I'm grateful for that. You lot have given me a lot here. You lot have given me a lot. And I think it would be really cheeky if I expected more. You know, judging and thinking. I used to do all that stuff. They should be sharing better than that. Why are they saying that? They should be doing it my way, you know. But you can only give what you've got. You know, if you haven't got it, how are you going to bloody give it? You know, but my God has got it. So I continue to connect with God, and every day I get what I bloody need. Beautiful, eh? Don't always get what I want, and that's okay, but I get what I need. And step 12 is about having that spiritual connection through working the steps, spiritual awakening, through working the steps on a daily basis. Susan has changed. I was going to say my surname then, and get really carried away. I'm going to give you my address soon. You can all come round. You know, but so I work with other people and I practice honesty, open-mindedness and willingness on a daily basis. I've got to be open-minded. I used to be really narrow-minded. If it weren't my way, it just couldn't work. But today I've got an open mind. I'm willing to learn, man. You know, this thing just goes on. It just gets better and better. And if you are struggling, as I said, and you are trying to control your using, that obviously means that you've got a problem. So stop controlling. I say give up, ask for help. And only do this if you want to live. If you don't want to live, because sometimes I never wanted to live, so I just used to use on purpose, not because of the obsession. I really just thought, I'm just going to go and smash it now, you know. But today, I'm going to stop here. The reason why I do this is because I want to live. I don't want to die, you know. And today I really am. I'm living. And I believe that I am an example, you know. I bear witness to God's power today, and I'm going to leave it there. Amen.
Thank you.